So we left the last week. We left with a presentation of particle detector models inspired by the light-matter interaction. Today we're gonna discuss about the covariance of the model, because if we want to have a particle detector that makes sense, there are two reasons to introduce particle detectors. Reason number one is, well, I just want to make measurements of quantum field. That's a fundamental issue. So particle detectors are just an artifact to be able to perform POVMs on the field that preserve causality. Or be it because, oh, well, I want to describe something realistic, the way we actually measure fields. We want to describe a physical system. Either way, you need particle detectors to couple in a way that the system is, that you don't violate causality, or at least if you do, you have control in which ways you violate causality, so you don't have superluminal signaling or any other phenomenon like that, as we will discuss. Now, one of the problems, above all, if you're very used to formulations of quantum field theory, one of the problems that come to mind when we want to make this formulation covariant, if you ever see quantum optics or any other setup like that, the formulation is very QM, is very Hamiltonian in a way. We start from the Hamiltonian and we say, yes, we have a detector, say, the free Hamiltonian of the detector is of this form. There's an energy gap omega and two levels, say, to simplify the thing, ground and excited state. We have a field. Let's just write the energy of the field, the Hamiltonian of the field, as this integral, after, of course, throwing out zero mode energy, zero point energy. Sorry, not zero mode. And then we write an interaction Hamiltonian. The problem with all that, right, is, well, the Hamiltonian formulation is really nice when you're working with non-relativistic systems. The problem we have here is that we have two or more systems, because we may have more than one detector, above all in most interesting scenarios. And those systems, the usual recipe in quantum optics is say, oh, yeah, the total Hamiltonian is the sum of the free Hamiltonian, for the field, for the detector, and then the interaction Hamiltonian, and then as many detectors as you have. And you got it. Now, the problem with this, though, is that every Hamiltonian, I mean, you may have a good reason to prescribe the Hamiltonian rather than anything else, because remember, we're talking here about a particle detector, which is a non-relativistic system. There is no quantum field theory for a particle detectors. And by that, I mean, well, do you have any quantum field theory for a realistic atom? Because if you do, awesome, you can get positronium, I guess, but it's a non-perturbative solution, and if you can do calculations with that, please come see me, and we're gonna break the field. The problem is that we cannot, we're not clever enough to do calculations with fully relativistic particle detectors. So we consider systems for which non-relativistic approximations are really good for the internal dynamics. And yeah, we don't have a good prescription for a Hamiltonian density in the way we do it for an action, in the way we do it in a field. We need to tailor-made ad hoc the system under the assumptions that we have. Now, you cannot combine, you cannot just sum up these three things, because in general, you're gonna quantize the field in a frame that is very different from the proper frame of the detector, or if you want the proper frame of the center of mass of the detector. So this Hamiltonian, so I have a good reason, so let's discuss a little bit who prescribes what. Who prescribes this Hamiltonian? Like, who's the person that tells me I have two levels and there's an energy gap omega? The reasonable frame in which we prescribe the Hamiltonian is the Hamiltonian that is commoving with the detector. It's when you're in the lab, if you're analyzing an atom, you are like commoving with the atom and then you measure the energy gap. Does that sound reasonable? That's how you get the textbook tables and numbers for the atom. Sounds reasonable that the prescription of the free Hamiltonian of the atom is made in the center of mass frame of the atom or commoving with it? Yep. I mean, I want some reactions.
Yes.
Nice. So if that's right, then this thing, oops, my bad.
I mean, what's special about the center of mass, sorry?
Just commoving with the atom, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that we're gonna talk about the localized atoms. I mean, we're gonna move very soon for this course anyways to point-like atoms, to point-like approximation for the atoms. But remember that the atoms are extended, right? And there was a Smerian vector for the electromagnetic model that we had. There was a Smerian vector, which is related with the wave functions of the ground and excited state of the atoms. So that's why I call center of mass frame of the atom. We will talk a little bit about that, because there will be important points related to rigidity of the atoms or not when we go relativistic. But for now, just say co-moving with the atom. Co-moving with the proton, whatever you want. Center of mass of the atom. There was a question? OK. Sometimes I think that's a question. So I wrote a tau here, because as prescribed, this Hamiltonian should generate translations with respect to the proper time of the atom. Because when you prescribe the model, where you measure that the energy levels, and when you study the atom was actually co-moving with respect to you. Now for the field. For the field, we went through canonical quantization. That means that we have Klein-Gordon equations. And in the moment I write creation and annihilation operators, it means that I've gone through canonical quantization. I've selected modes, all right? And I did that in a particular frame. If I'm not masochistic, I would have picked an inertial frame. I mean, sometimes you can't, but imagine you're in flat space-time, right? In that case, you definitely would pick an inertial frame to do it. So let's call the quantization frame. You can do it in others, for sure. There's no problem doing it. Well, yeah, there are problems doing it in others. But I picked an inertial frame just for simplicity. So the quantization frame Tx, which is where I know how to solve Klein-Gordon equations really well. Then this is the free Hamiltonian of the field. And this Hamiltonian generates translations with respect to time t associated with the quantization frame of the field. All right? Now, here's a question that is a quantum optics question, but it's usually not looked at in quantum optics. With respect to what time does the interaction Hamiltonian generate translations? This one's very clear. And I have to prescribe an interaction Hamiltonian. Remember the dipole or the monopole, if you have a monopole interaction. So say that you have some interaction of the form, some switching, say, I don't know. I'm going to write the dependence on switching, some mu degree of freedom, and some field degree of freedom, just to give you the shape of it. Remember the dipole coupling. Now, with respect to what time you think is reasonable to prescribe translations, when we say this is the way matter interacts with light. Any ideas? We can conduct a survey. There are only two times that I've talked about here. How many people would think that we should write this? So this is by default, you know, when, remember that these things come from first principles. Remember the first principles that it came from? Non-relativistic first principles, in a way, as in like the atom, the electron doesn't move relativistically. The electron was p squared divided by 2m for its free energy plus the Coulomb potential. How many people would think it should be a t? 1, 2, 3. How many people think it should be a tau? Okay, I wonder, what is your rationale for t, over set t? Why t?
Because you said first principles weren't relativistic.
But we have two frames here, right? So either way would be okay in terms of relativity, right? If you do the things right.
I think this interaction Hamiltonian has no relationship with the detector two level, so it should be in the quantization frame itself.
Okay. I want reasons for the other side. Who wants to give me some? Or one?
I saw their presentation.
Right. Let's think of the easiest way. Imagine that you put yourself in the center of mass of the atom. So you're talking about a dipole, and dipole couples to the field. The dipole is seen, the reference frame for the dipole is the center of mass of the atom. In the usual picture, you get a proton kind of thing. Imagine if it was a classical atom, right? You get a proton, you get a dipole, and that dipole exists, and it's an X referred to the center of mass of the atom. The field is frame invariant, so it doesn't matter which frame we choose to. Invariant and the changes of inertial reference frame. It doesn't matter what inertial frame we pick for that. But the interaction is saying, OK, now I'm the atom. I possess a dipole. And I'm coupling to whatever the field is. This is prescribed from the frame of the atom, all right, which is where the dipole is seen. So this thing should have a tau in here. All right. I could have prescribed it. This is a prescription, right? But if I want to base it, you are not tied to this prescription. You could have prescribed it in a different way. It would be against what everybody does. but you could have. The one that is actually based on a first principle derivation is this choice. Okay. All right, so now, given a Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to T, hopefully was obvious because I was not vocal about it. I write here the parameter with respect to which these Hamiltonians generate translations. Okay? So these Hamiltonians are, the classical version are, this is a partial tau, this is a partial T, right? Now, given a Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to time translations with respect to a time parameter T, if I reparameterize time, this is a problem of classical mechanics, simple time reparameterization, right? Just to illustrate, I use Schrödinger equation because it's very easy to see here, right? Question is, okay, now I reparameterize time, how does the Hamiltonian change? You would think, you wouldn't think, but many people may think, above all, if they're not used to working with relativity, they would say, right, so if I have h of t, that thing gets mapped to just h of t of tau, and that's it. But not quite, because what you're doing here, if you do that, you would be doing just this. I just get the Hamiltonian that generates translation with respect to t, now expressed as a function of tau. I'm changing bases, if you want, for the Hamiltonian, but I'm not changing the Hamiltonian. It's the same Hamiltonian, generates translation with respect to the same direction in space-time. Quick way to see it with Schrödinger equation is like, yeah, sure. So let me just reparameterize the equation with a time tau. So the derivative with respect to t is just product rule. This factor, let me call it redshift factor, times derivative with respect to tau. And then I do definitely rewrite h of t as a function of tau. But then this doesn't look like a Schrödinger equation. If I want to canonically write it as a Schrödinger equation, I need to put that there. If I put that there, then I realize that the actual Hamiltonian that generates translations with respect to tau, because this equation, Schrödinger equation, I say that a lot. Schrödinger equation is not really anything quantum. Do you agree with that statement? It's a bit weird. Schrödinger equation is just the statement of, I call h the generator of tau translations. All right, basically, I'm saying the exponential map of some ih pushes the psi in the direction of time. And this is a restatement of that. Just differentiate that equation. There is nothing quantum when we write Schrödinger equation. I can write it because this could be classical. I could get a Hilbert space representation of something classical. See what I mean? This thing is just a restatement of, I call h the generator of translation with respect to t. Yeah?
What about the I there?
I can get a complex representation, no problem. So I can complexify. How about alpha and alpha star, right? In the when you have phase space, you have x and p as canonical variables, but I can complexify that. I can actually change to alpha and alpha star, alpha being q plus ip. So you know what I mean? Like you can certainly get this structure in classical mechanics as well. This is not, it becomes quantum when you actually discuss where this comes from and what is inside, right? But this statement as it is just, let's write a Hilbert space for a reason. The difference is that in quantum you need a hat map and you need a Hilbert space representation, for sure. But maybe for no reason I just decide to write this funny representation for my classical phase space, which I can, right? And then I say that I call H the generator of time translations. That's all. That's why, again, I usually tell when I teach quantum, I tell, this is not what I would call Schrödinger equation until I tell me what that is. But again, subtleties. Anyway, we see now that the Hamiltonian that generates time translations with respect to a different parameter, right, is a redshift factor times the Hamiltonian that generates translations with the old variable. Of course, if you want to write in terms of tau, everything written in terms of tau. Okay? All right. So if you have, let's just write the interaction Hamiltonian. You need to reparameterize. So you see if you want to write this Hamiltonian in terms of tau, then it's easy. You just add a gamma factor, right? Gamma factor meaning this. I'll call it gamma factor and redshift factor, so please bear with me. All right. So when we take the interaction picture for the field, we need to consider gamma that. All right, if we had a point light detector, this is pretty easy. Because a point light detector, if you get, say, that what we want to do is this. So you have space-time. And this is connecting with a way in which I always try to talk about particle detectors. In QM, and oftentimes in quantum field theory too, above all if the approach is less fundamental, I'm not talking about when you see fundamental field theory, but when you see more operational particle physics-oriented field theory, usually we write time evolution operators, as I said, with a T0 and a T, and perhaps taking both to infinity and minus infinity, and so on. There's this notion of the instantaneous state of something, right? You get a state at time T0, you apply U, the time evolution operator, which is the complex exponential time order of the Hamiltonian, and that takes me from T0 to T, and then there's the state at T, right? That is not great. It's much better to talk about processes. And in fact, that's the only thing that we can make sense of. So you have some, say this is some foliation of flat space-time. Then you get a Cauchy surface here. Then you get a Cauchy surface here. And then something happens in between, which is I prepare my state, I couple the detector to the field, I in the end measure and so on. So I have a time evolution operator that goes from here to here. And that thing is not sharp. In general, it's a process with all that the process conveys, and that is captured by this switching function that I have here. Now, if I had a point-like detector, we will see it explicitly. If I had a point-like detector, this is already done. I know how to write the thing covariantly. How? Well, because I have U, right? Time evolution operator is the time order integral of the exponential of minus I dt, h or d tau, if we write it like that, d tau, h tau, right? And this Hamiltonian depends on tau. And then this Hamiltonian would be interaction, this is interaction picture. So let me write the interaction picture here. And this Hamiltonian, this interaction Hamiltonian would only be supported in the support of the switching function, right? And this thing, of course, is equal to the time order exponential of minus I dt. And now right here, d tau dt, h of t, t interaction. So for point light detectors, a quick recipe is just, well, if you want to write it in a covariant way, in a way that doesn't depend on the inertial frame you're describing things, all that you need to do is add the gamma factor, right? Agreed?
No.
OK, go for it. Why not?
I mean, like the square root of the gamma factor?
Substitute.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the point, right? That it's not covariant.
It is covariant. This thing is equal. These things cancel. You want to cancel. It is covariant. I could do for you an explicit calculation. I can show you where it is. Explicit calculation done to show that. But you see, it's the same amount, right? The Hamiltonian maps to that. There is the same time order exponential, no? What's the difference between the left and the right?
No. I agree that the equal sign is correct, but the formulas do not look the same.
Oh, that's what you mean. Yeah. But covariant, here I mean, that you get the same. So if you actually do a transformation, now you're going to get a different surface and a different surface in a different set of coordinates. And the state here and the state here are the same. That's what I mean by covariant. Not that they look the same. Well, I'll write it eventually fully covariant. So no more fully covariant within reason. OK. Are we on the same page then?
Sorry, I don't know why this is true. I mean,
what's that?
So there's a factor from Jacobian and other factor from the.
If it's point-like, no. Right? This is only one variable. This is only one variable. This is your Jacobian.
Yeah, but h tau h log equals to th h.
What's that?
The factor of dt d tau.
Mm-hmm. Which is here.
Yeah, but you are saying that factor is from Jacobian.
No, what I'm saying is the same factor as the Jacobian. This is a, think of it as a change of variables, and this is literally the change of variable factors. Agreed? I just did a substitution, right? Do you agree that this is equal to that? All right. That's all that I did. There's no mystery. There's nothing funny in here. I just wanted to thermalize with it. Now, this would be all good, except for the fact that detectors, at least the ones that I derived from first principle, right, are extended objects. Remember, there was a smearing vector. And that means that the detectors are extended over the support of the wave functions of the ground and the excited state. Now, what's the problem with extended objects in relativity? They cannot really move in a coherent rigid way. So what happens in reality, though? In reality, we do have extended objects, no? So think that I have an atom, and I accelerate, physically grab the atom and accelerate it. What's going on then? So I have a hydrogen atom, say, or my finger, which is made of a lot of hydrogen atoms and other things, but mainly hydrogen atoms. And I move it like this. It seems to have worked, no? OK, so what happened? If you take a hydrogen atom and you move it in a non-inertial trajectory even, have I destroyed the atom? Well, if I'm not a beast accelerating, no, I'm not. I haven't destroyed the atom, right? OK, so it is possible to accelerate extended objects, right? Have you checked your, what was tutorial zero? What's it called that? The bar, the Bell rocket paradox, right? It is possible to get a rod and accelerate it, no? The only thing is that you need to accelerate every point of the rod with a different acceleration. Right? So what happens with an atom is that the atom has internal coherent forces. The internal cohesion forces keep the atom whole as you accelerate it. Mm-hmm. So the approximation that we usually use for particle detectors is that the particle detectors that is delocalized remains rigid as seen from a particular frame, right, which is the center of mass frame of the detector. So that should ring a bell with Fermi-Walker frames. Huh? No? Have you seen Fermi-Walker frames in G? No? Oh, I thought. OK. Well, let's just write. So if you have, let's write a Hamiltonian, the generous translation with respect to T, interaction between field and detector. And let's make a proposal for one. Right. So. Yeah, sorry, I have a coupling strength to begin with. Let's call it lambda. I have a switching function that controls the length and strength of the interaction. I need a frame, so let me pick the center of mass frame of the detector, remember? Okay, so the trajectory of the center of mass of the detector is this, in the detector frame, of course. And then I say, yeah, so what I do now is I integrate n dimensions over the extension of the detector. So I get here some smearing function. Then I couple the monopole. This thing would make the monopole operator. And then I couple the field. And the field I'm going to decide to write it as an expansion of modes on a quantization frame, Tx. So this would be a T of tau xi and an x of tau xi. So that's an attempt of writing a detector Hamiltonian, a detector field interaction Hamiltonian, which is basically what we had before, right? The one that came from first principles. Get your monopole operator, couple it to the field, and integrate over the extension of the field. Only that now the field is quantized in a frame that is different from the detectors. And the detector can be undergoing an arbitrary trajectory, right? So the detector, this is the trajectory on the center of mass frame. But of course, you have a detector that in the quantization frame has a non-trivial trajectory, right? Let me call it lab frame, the quantization frame. Yeah.
If we have a field that is non-scalar, would it suffer a Lorentz transformation?
Yeah, certainly so. Yes. So if you actually, so we will get there as the way to write it, right? The coupling should be written in a way that is covariant, right? If you have something else, but I'm doing the scalar one first to avoid that. But yes, indeed, this thing could be would indeed be transformed, Lorentz transform. Yep.
What did you say xi was?
Xi, this one?
No, the xi.
Ah, sorry, this one.
Yeah.
Is the spatial coordinate in the center of mass of the detector. So there are two frames, right? The quantization frame and the detector frame. So the center of mass of the detector frame, I assign coordinates tau xi. All right. Now the problem you have with this is that the time evolution that is generated, I mean, if you've seen the Bruno's and Rick's presentation, then you, there's some spoilers there. But still, the problem we have with this is that the prediction, so the time evolution operator, the same way, if it were a point-like detector doing that, you get this equal to that. Here, it's slightly different, right? Because this is an integral over Rn. And this integral, which is reasonable, again, this is reasonable to talk about. Reasonable, I'm not saying correct, reasonable. If only the frame of the detector existed. If only the frame of the detector existed, then fine. This is OK to talk about. But we want to be able to express time evolution on any frame we want. In mind that we have more than one detector, and they go on different trajectories. And we need to add up all those Hamiltonians. How do you do it? They're going to look different. And not only now, we have the partial tau pointing in different directions as partial t. Now we have the problem that the foliation of spacetime that allows you to do the partition, the foliation of spacetime associated with the center of mass frame of the detector would be different for different detectors in different motion. Even worse, every point of the detector has a different partial tau, because they're moving in general in non-inertial trajectories and in general in curved spacetimes, right? So having extended objects makes it very complicated, above all when you have more than one detector. Now, how do we deal with that? Okay. Well, the way we deal with that in quantum field theory is like, well, forget about why are you building your first principle theory out of Hamiltonians? That is not okay. Instead of that, build it out of densities. Well, because densities come much easier from an action, because densities are written in a way that when you write all the Hamiltonians, everything is explicitly covariant. So let's propose a Hamiltonian density. How? Let's look at the time evolution operator. Time evolution operator looks like that. With an h in there. But you know what I can do? I have a spatial integral in here. I can write explicitly the spatial integral in here. So I have here r, I have here rn. And then you say, well, then I can write something here. I mean, again, there's a convention here, and which one you ascribe to. For now, let me explicitly say, let me write something here, which is a Hamiltonian density associated with this foliation of spacetime. And then by inspection, if you take it here, you say this Hamiltonian density, what would it be? Well, it would be the switching times the coupling, the smearing function, the mu, and the field, right? Without the integral. Now, the problem that you have with this, though, is that written as that, so it depends what is your preference. So here's a question for you. When I talk about a Hamiltonian density, for you, it's a density or a scalar? This is a convention. Does this thing for you have a determinant of the metric inside square root or not?
Yes.
It does. Well, it depends on this convention, depending if you do more particle physics or you do more relativity, is one or the other. So let me then, just to make everyone happy, right? Let me call this thing H tilde. This is the scalar. So if this is the scalar, this is a density, and I want this thing to be invariant, I need to run the invariant element of volume here. The invariant element of volume has the determinant of the metric in it. All right? So if I write, so this would be the Hamiltonian density in the GR sense, the one that includes this determinant of the metric. And this H tilde would be, I'll write it, H tilde tau xi would be lambda tau f mu phi right like that. So if I want to prescribe a Hamiltonian so that, and then there will be issues. So imagine for a second that this time ordering wasn't there. If this time ordering wasn't there, then it's pretty clean that if I prescribe my Hamiltonian so that it comes from this density, or this density, depending on your convention, then if I reparameterize this to a different frame, or I consider a different trajectory, the integral, the exponential of this integral will be exactly the same. As you said, I mean, covariant in the sense that it's correct. It gives the same result in all frames, because that's precisely the Jacobian of the transformation that you get. So if I prescribe my interaction with this Hamiltonian scalar, if you want, the convention is a little bit confusing if I say. But if I prescribe, don't call this anything, with this Hamiltonian density, right? Then my interaction, the predictions of my interaction are impervious to changes of reference frame. If I make a prediction, I compute in a frame, and I make a prediction, I compute in a different frame, I would get the same. If I want to combine, and this is why we need this the most, if I want to have several detectors, sometimes I want to do crazy things with entanglement in field theory, and if I want to do crazy things with entanglement, I may need to consider two detectors moving in different trajectories, or in a curved spacetime in general, two detectors that don't have the same partial tau, the center of masses, right? So I need to write this in a way that allows me to just sum the Hamiltonian densities, right? And then construct the Hamiltonian in a given frame out of the Hamiltonian density. And this is the way that would give you the right result, the invariant result. So what we did is, remember the first principles that I did was actually particularizing a frame to get to this point to prescribe the interaction, like this. So if you want to write the Hamiltonian, this is a tau. If I want to write the Hamiltonian tau, let me just write it. Sorry, maybe I'll write it in an arbitrary t. If I want to write the Hamiltonian in an arbitrary t, t prime, the interaction Hamiltonian, this thing would be the integral. This is important. So psi tau of t prime, then I have the f of psi of t prime. So let's say that I'm doing a frame, I'll call it t prime x prime, and in fact, this will be p prime x prime. Then an f, that would be psi p prime x prime. Then a mu, that would be t tau p prime x prime. Then, of course, the field, t of p prime x prime, x of p prime x prime. But also, I need to add, oh, I'm missing the integral. Sorry, my bad. And it's not going to fit anyway, so I'll do it here. If I write the Hamiltonian, let's get the eraser. The Hamiltonian in an arbitrary frame that I'm going to call t prime x prime, I can get out the Hamiltonian density. And this Hamiltonian, t prime, it's equal to lambda. Now, integral dn x prime. Now, determinant of the metric, super important. This is, so I'm considering, and this is the standard convention in RQI, I'm considering a spacetime of n plus one dimensions. So for me, n is the number of spatial dimensions, okay? So this metric here, the determinant of the metric, is not the determinant of the metric of the spatial metric. It's the full four-dimensional metric, okay? So this is not the element of volume, of spatial volume. It's kind of the element of spatial volume. I mean, the metric were diagonal times the resid factor. But the metric doesn't even have to be diagonal, so it's not even that. All right. So this, and then I write psi of tau of t x prime. And then I have f psi t prime x prime. Then I have the mu, same thing, tau t prime x prime. And then I have phi t of t prime x prime, x t prime x prime. So there you go. That is the Hamiltonian. How did we get the Hamiltonians for an arbitrary, from the generalized translation with respect to t prime? Coming from an arbitrary frame, that allows you to combine Hamiltonians when you have more than one detector. How did we get to that thing? We got to that Hamiltonian by first fixing a frame, center of mass frame of detector, very non-covariant approach. And then from the electromagnetic interaction, from the electromagnetic coupling of an electron in an atom and the field, we derive a Hamiltonian. Then the next thing, well, we'll consider that the Hamiltonian is corresponding to an extended object, and that we may have different frames for the quantization frame and the detector center of mass frame. Now, after doing that, we say, okay, yes, but we want to keep the predictions covariant in the, and by covariant, I mean, well, I don't want you, when I reparameterize to a different frame, to evolve, I want just to evolve a Cauchy surface to the same Cauchy surface, sorry, a Cauchy surface to a Cauchy surface and do the same in the different frame. So I have to demand for this notion of covariance, I have to demand this. Of course, this is for a scalar theory, as you were saying. Here you would have the transform field as well. So if this were an E in the electromagnetic case, you have the Lorentz transform. It would mix magnetic fields as well. All right? Any questions about this so far? Yeah?
Sorry. So you include that determinant G to have that Jacobian?
So this one is just for time reparametrizations.
Yes.
This assumes that your detector is point-like. The problem that we have is our detector is not point-like. Our detector is actually an integral of some density.
Yes, yes.
And because an integral of some density, to fix that spatial extension, you had to select a foliation of spacetime.
Yes.
That is a time direction and a spatial direction. Therefore, this integral over space here, if you just naively say, oh, let's just integrate over the volume, then this is not going to be covariant when you put it inside the U. Because when you put it inside the U, for the integral to be the same, you need to have the right Jacobian factor, let's call it that, in here. So what we did here is let's add the Jacobian factor so that the whole prediction is the same in all frames. So we got, basically, this is the process, the usual process, right? You know it in one frame, and you also know how to translate prediction in one frame to an arbitrary frame, explicitly write it. and that gives you the Hamiltonian. That's the way we build these things. Right? Oh, and one frame is really easy and comes from first principles. But of course, I need to write it for to be valid in any frame, and also because I'm going to combine detectors in different states of motion and in different points in space-time. So, oh, I also know how to make it covariant in that way. But let's just do it. Let's add the change of coordinates, Jacobian of the transformation. Now, this is a small subtlety. Bruno and Rick can tell you more about. I'm not going to talk much about it. The small subtlety is that we also have a time ordering operator in here. So if you change frames, the direction of time changes, obviously, and the time ordering becomes something else. If you just go with this, then you can prove for. So let me first put your minds at ease in terms of causality, or what we will discuss causality, like the ability of the detector to signal or to do faster than light stuff, is not affected by what I'm about to say. But there is something, this is not super clean in terms of covariance, right? When we have extended detectors. And then why not? Because in the non-relativistic approximation of the atom, we are saying that the degree of freedom of the atom, the internal degree of freedom, this thing, the mu, it's coupled at the same time to an extension of spatial points. So the atom knows instantaneously what happens at one extreme of the wave function and the other extreme of the wave function. So that is a violation of covariance. You're like simultaneously coupled. It's already the time. Yeah. Oh, no. We still have time, no? Until today, we have until
30.
Perfect. So the the detector is an extended object, and therefore is seeing several points of space-time that are space-like separated at the same time. This is a violation of covariance. But that is the same violation of covariance as saying my atom is non-relativistic. The non-relativistic description for the atom is a good one. Therefore, with your atom, you're limited to predictions that are much longer in time than the line crossing time of the atom. So you are forced, if you're in a point-like approximation, no problem, because the detector only sees one point and everything is causal. But in general, it's not fully causal, because you're seeing the detector is coupling to an extension of space, right? Now, this extension of space is arguably small, so these smearing functions are going to be very suppressed in space, okay? And as long as your predictions are not within the light crossing distance of the atom, this is the same degree. So the error that you have by not considering this extension is the same order of error that you have by considering that my atom, to a good extent, is a good approximation, the non-relativistic approximation for the atom. All right, but that's the only caveat. Is that understood? So that actually gets in the way when you try to operate with the time ordering. The smearing gets in the way. For point-like detectors, no problem. Point-like detectors, the whole thing is fully covariant. Now, that one you can write in a fully covariant form. That is the same form for everybody, right? I just change the coordinates, and this is, if I claim this is fully covariant, hopefully you'll be happy. Any questions? Time ordering is tricky. But again, I'm thinking if you guys are in the second part, you can give a presentation about that bit, because everybody will do presentation in the second part. Yes?
So if it's point-like, then we don't even need to do that, right? We can just work with it.
Correct. That's right. That's the next thing I'm going to do. So let's write now. Hopefully I have enough time for this. Let's assume that we have now, that we are revisiting the transition probability of the detector, and say that we have now a point-like detector. Consider point-like detector, which means that f of xi is a delta of xi. So if we have a point-like detector, then let's assume the initial state of detector and field, and take another, is say the ground state and an arbitrary state of the field. Okay. Now, compute the probability of going from ground to excited in the presence of this arbitrary state of the field. The only assumption is that we start from the ground state, completely uncorrelated, of course, with the arbitrary state of the detector or the field. Now, we write the Hamiltonian. If you put a delta in there, what you would get, say, that is inertial, consider flat spacetime. Right? So in flat spacetime is nice because the determinant of the metric, I'm not going to go crazy with the coordinates. So the determinant of the metric is very simple in flat spacetime. And what we get is that the Hamiltonian generate translation with respect to tau. It's equal to lambda. And then I write, let me write for now tau over t, capital T, here. Integral, well, I don't need to write the integral anymore. It's a mu of tau. And what the integral does when you have a delta is basically sets phi on the trajectory of the detector, right? It's following t at the center of mass of the detector and x at the center of mass of the detector. So what we get is phi t of, let me just write it, tau 0, x tau 0, just using the delta to do the integral. And this thing, let me just call t of tau for short, and x of tau, which is the trajectory of the detector, parameterized in terms of the proper time of the detector. OK, so if I have that, let's compute the probability. What's the probability? So that's easy, no? Ground to excited. Right, so this thing is the trace on the projector on the state that you want, right? Which is the excited state. And the time evolved density matrix. Right? All right. Now, so let's see. Let's see what we have here. Let's do it. Maybe I can do it here. Right, so if I have rho 0, my initial state, then rho after the process, let's call it capital T, it's equal to, right, u, rho 0, u. I can do a Dyson expansion here. And this thing would be, of course, rho 0 plus u1, rho 0 plus rho 0, u1. Plus u1 rho 0 u1 dagger plus u2 rho 0 plus rho 0 u2 plus things of order lambda cube. Agreed?
No, the third term should have a dagger, right?
Yes. Thank you. And this one too?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. So if we are going to substitute this here, we can actually run a little bit because rho 0. Rho 0 has g. But g is orthogonal to e. So no contribution from rho 0 in here. All right. How about u2? U2 has operators that are either the operators that go in U2 for the detector are going to be of the form sigma plus sigma minus, sigma minus sigma plus, right? So this thing doesn't change the parity of the state G. So in particular, for two levels, respect G to G. right? So this U2 doesn't contribute at all for the transition to E. Agreed? All that it can do is excited and de-excited again. So you go back to G. So no contributions from U2 either. What about U1? Well, U1 are contributions that will change, are making non-diagonal in the detector, okay? So the diagonal terms are gonna be zero, agreed? So U1, what U1 would do, acting on the detector, would either change this G to E, but only this the left G to E, or change the right G to E, but only the right G to E. Agreed? So it would be non-diagonal, has zero diagonal EE element. So the U1 alone does not contribute. The only non-zero contribution to that transition probability is the U1 row 0, U1 dagger at order 2. And also, there's no order 3. There's going to be order 4, the next one. It's just parity, right? This, all that I did is counting excitations and associating parity, OK? Now, if we do that, that's pretty neat, because this thing becomes E U1 row 0 U1 dagger E. Ah, trace over the field. Sorry, my bad. Trace over the field of E U row 0 U1 dagger. Of course, U1 is minus I integral minus infinity to infinity dt of tau. So expanding this, one gets, should I write it here? Yeah, let me write it here. That this is equal to lambda square d tau prime, okay? And then you get psi tau t, psi tau prime t, E mu tau g, g mu tau prime, E. Then trace over the field of row of the field, phi of t of tau prime, x of tau prime. Oh, did I do? Well, I'll tell you what I did in a minute. Phi of t of tau, x of tau. So what I did, what I did in here, right, you would have the U1 and the U1 we took with the tau. This thing in here comes from a previous step, if you want, that was trace of phi t, t of tau, x of tau, rho phi t of tau prime, x of tau prime. Right, and then cyclic property to write it like this. Yeah?
Can you repeat y2, 0?
Which one? This? This one?
Yeah.
Right. Because u2 has two monopole operators, right?
Okay.
On one side, because it's acting on one side. So you're going to get of the form. So remember, the monopole operator is of this form, sigma plus e to the I omega t plus sigma minus e to the minus I omega t, right? So if you multiply two from the left, sigma plus square is 0, sigma minus square is 0. So all that you get is, right?
Yeah.
And that thing doesn't change the parity. In fact, for a two level, it keeps the same level. In particular, for this case, this will keep the ground state. This will give you nothing. So the same from the other side. So the contribution from the two are 0. Yeah, thanks. Please do ask those questions. Yeah, yeah. Appreciate them. Also, you may ask, why did you write a t in here? I wrote a t in here because I'm going to consider switching functions that have a time scale. All right, so that's just explicitly saying that it's going to depend on some time scale. There's nothing. It's the same as the excite t that I wrote before, psi tau. All right, like super important, right? So this that I wrote here, this thing, we computed the other day. And what we got is, if I'm not mistaken, e to the I omega tau minus tau prime. And this thing here is a very important object in field theory. That thing there is what we call the Whiteman function, which is W, let me write four vector here, x, x prime, I define as the expectation value s, x, x prime, one row. That's the two-point, actually, Weinmann function. Also called two-point function, often, for short. So what we have right there, that's the Weinmann function. So this thing, if you have, and this is important, this is part of the discussion I want, this would be the trace of pi x. X prime. Of course, you can tell if you swap the two coordinates using the cyclic property of the trace, you get the same thing except for the row on the other side. These two guys are self-adjoint, so that means that the Weinmann of x prime x it's equal to the complex conjugate of the Weinmann x x prime. So the transition probability, having defined that, let me quickly write it here. Oops, no. This transition probability, I can write as lambda squared d tau prime, the two switchings, and then a Fourier transform factor and the Weinmann at row zero for the field on tau prime tau. And in fact, I write it as tau prime tau because it's actually a pullback of the Weinmann function, the trajectory of the detector, which shows up here, right? What is meant by tau prime tau in here is of t of tau prime, x of tau prime. Okay. Now, yeah.
Switching functions. Now they're over. Use tau over.
Oh, I call it sigma, my bad. Yeah, thank you. Very used to calling it sigma, so sometimes I might make that mistake. Thank you. So this Weinmann function is a very important object. So look at that. First of all, the transition probability of the detector has information about the Weinmann function. What is actually seen at leading order is the two-point function. Agreed? That's general. I didn't assume any state for the detector. Sorry, for the field. Now, the Weinmann function, have you seen the Weinmann function in your field theory courses? It depends on the optics of the field theory courses that you've seen. They may or may not have not introduced them. You certainly have seen the Feynman propagator. Feynman propagator is this with a time ordering in front. Okay. Well, the Weinmann function, let's see what the imaginary part. By the way, when I write funny x's, I mean for vectors, okay? I'm using the usual notation in algebraic quantum field theory, right, which is used actually serif kind of fonts for the four vectors. But of course, also my handwriting on the board, I just put funny lines on them. What is the imaginary part of this? The imaginary part of this, of course, is, well, 1 over 2i Weinmann x x prime minus Weinmann x x prime which is the trace of rho multiplying I of x prime minus phi of x prime phi of x. Oh, well, that's neat. What is this? 1 over 2i, the expectation value of, maybe I should have used regular. The expectation value of the commutator of the field in algebraic field theory, this has a name. This is called the Pauli-Jordan distribution. It's the expectation value of the commutator in the state of the field. Which, if it's a free theory, you know that this is state independent, right? And the real part well, I don't need to compute it because it's obvious, right? If one is the commutator, the other one has to be the anti-commutator. So this is 1 over 2, the expectation of the anti-commutator. And this is called the Hadamard distribution for the field state. All right, so before we finish, right. First of all, we see that the response of a detector to any state of the field, the probability of getting the detector excited, the clicking statistics of the detector, it's in the Wyman function. The Wyman function that I define as the two-point function of the field, the Wyman two-point function, can be decomposed into a commutator part that is state independent if your theory is free, and an anti-commutator part, which is state dependent. One quick way of saying that the model is causal, and we will do that in the second part of the course, is actually showing that the communication between two particle detectors is only through terms like this. If the communication between two particle detectors is through these terms, then we know that microcausality already guarantees that they cannot communicate if they're space-like separated, right? Because if x and x prime are space-like separated, the commutator of the field is zero. Now, very important before moving to other things is that this tells you that particle detector theory does not need to be restricted to canonically quantizable fields or even path integral quantizable fields. Why so? So I don't know if you know about something called the Wyman reconstruction theorem. Have you heard that? How many people have heard something like that? All right, so remember, when people were trying to do quantum field theory rigorously, I said, look, quantum field theory is a chaos, it's a mess, it's actually an utter mess. You know that, because you've been exposed to it. Infinites everywhere, things that you cannot do everywhere, you do them anyways, sometimes ratios work, sometimes they don't, then you renormalize, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. When you can't, what you do, when you make it up, you know, it's an utter mess. When mathematicians took a look at quantum field theory, they said, no, hold on, I mean, what about we do what von Neumann did for quantum mechanics? Quantum mechanics was an utter mess. Quantum mechanics regular was a mess when it was first proposed. But then von Neumann arrived and a bunch of other people and said, oh, no, hold on, this is all okay and you can do this like this. This is the right way of doing it. The people who did the same or in the works of doing the same for quantum field theory, a Wyman, and so there are two generations, you want three, Wyman, and then people like Hegerfeld, Hag, Redhead, many people working on that, which is the axiomatic approach to quantum field theory. And what Wyman said is like, well, quantization processes are a mess. So why don't we instead axiomatize quantum field theory? The same way we in quantum mechanics start from some postulates, all right? Maybe going from classical to quantum, we know there's a theorem, congruence rule theorem, that tells you that you cannot go from quantum to classical to quantum. I gave you an example on the sideboard the other day. How about well, we have postulates and we know how to do it from scratch then. Fine. How about we do something like that for quantum field theory? If you take that path for quantum field theory, your fundamental objects are the endpoint functions, the correlators of the field. These are the fundamental subjects of the theory. Now, if you have the whole structure of canonical quantization, of path integral quantization, right, you can write this this way. This is canonical quantization. Or you can write it as derivative of some partition function and the path integrals over some partition functions. But those two steps are highly non-trivial. The fundamental objects of the theory are actually these guys, the endpoint correlators. The reconstruction theorem that Wyman tells you is like, well, if I want to build a full quantum field theory, all that I need to know is all the infinite endpoint correlators. And actually, if my states are quasi-free, which is the same as saying Gaussian, there are theorems that tell me that the two-point function is enough. Right? Think of weak theorem. You can write all the endpoint functions as two-point functions and products of. So these are the fundamental objects of the theory. The causal structure of the theory is in here. This is the bit that gives you the causal structure of the theory. And this is the bit that tells you that if you, this simplifying a little bit, right? Because this could be state dependent, that this is true. The Pauli-Jordan gives you the causal structure of the theory. That's what makes it relativistic. The Hadamard is what tells you how states, what states are. And interesting enough, so in axiomatic quantum field theory, in algebraic quantum field theory, states, now we give a lot of importance to states in our formulations of quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, but states are, from the point of view of axiomatic field theory, not as important. States, rho, are actually maps. Maps that take elements of a local algebra of observables. So I have, let's say, the field amplitude in here, living here. And what is a state? Well, a state takes that observable and returns an expectation value. That is the way you formulate quantum field theory axiomatically. That's the way you do it, full theorems and in full control. Now, this is powerful. People have proven immense amount of powerful results doing that. For example, the fact that projective measurements cannot exist in field theory using this formalism. The fact that the vacuum state of a quantum field in general is going to be entangled in space-like separated regions. That is proven using this stuff. Problem with that is that it's not practical in the sense that making predictions with it is tough. It's a very pure math-based approach for it. My argument, detector physics is the bridge between axiomatic field theory and predicting power, results obtained in field theory calculations. They connect the two. Particle detectors are connected, the fundamental subjects of your theory, with predictable results. Without magic. And without magic, I mean, when you see quantum field theory in other contexts, usually there's magic involved. And I promise, there's magic involved. So you say, oh, it's reasonable that we can measure this, or we can say this, and so on. Here, there's no magic. It's all, you've seen the whole thing. It's a little bit, it's been a little bit fast, because I want to get to thermality for the next lecture. And it's only 1 hour next lecture as well, right? And you have a tutorial about thermality after that. That's why I was a little bit fast. But hopefully, I transmitted the ideas that let's recap. We derive from first principles in a given frame an interaction Hamiltonian between a non-relativistic particle detector that is localized in space and time and a quantum field that's fully relativistic. Then, with our knowledge of relativity, we extended those Hamiltonians to a fully covariant formalism. And then after that, I've discussed that what the detector sees, what the detector is connecting to, is the endpoint functions directly. This is going to be super important. We're going to use it a lot. And these endpoint functions are actually the important objects of the theory. If you ask me, those are the important objects of the theory. Also, you can, those are the things that you want to measure. All right? And then we also talked about the fact that the important object of the theory here can be decomposed into Pauli-Jordan and the Hadamard. This thing is also as a classical analog, right? This is the retarded Green function minus the advanced Green function as well. So this thing is pretty classical. It's the classical part of the theory. This is kind of the quantum part of the theory, the Hadamard here. The Wyman function is not a Green function. It's what we call a kernel. It's a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation twice. No kidding. You have one and another, so yes. Not to be confused with the Feynman propagator. The Feynman propagator has a time ordering here. And that time ordering makes it a Green function, actually. It doesn't solve Klein-Gordon equation. It solves Klein-Gordon equation with a delta inhomogeneity, delta source. The two are related, of course. I can write the Wyman function in terms of the Feynman propagator, and I can write the Feynman propagator in terms of Wyman function. All right, you can do the two things. You're more used usually to the Feynman propagator, no? I assume. Feynman propagator is helpful in particle physics. This is helpful in fundamental field theory. Now, the oftentimes you hear, of course, this is entanglement. The Feynman propagator does not cancel in space. Like, do not formulate things in terms of the Feynman propagator. Let's start talking about these objects here. Pauli Jordan and Hadamard. Okay. All right, the next thing I'm going to do, which is not now, of course, is for the next day, just to tell you what I'm going to do. We're going to quickly, because we want to advance towards the Andrew effect, as one of the paramount examples of using detector physics in a clear and nice way, we're going to have to talk about thermality. And what is thermal, right? Remember the Andrew effect, descriptively, the Andrew effect. An accelerated detector is a temperature, right? Thermal bath when it's accelerating. To understand that, we need to understand thermality in quantum field theory. Thermality in quantum field theory is tough. Because this notion, remember your notion of thermality, we will review all this. But the notion of thermality that you've seen before, if nobody here has seen KMS thermality, who has seen KMS thermality? You have. Okay. People who have not seen KMS thermality before. The notion of thermality you probably work with is the Gibbs notion of thermality, which is saying, right, it makes sense, right? The second law of thermodynamics tells me that in spontaneous processes, entropy increases, right? If I let a system equilibrate, thermalize, it will undergo spontaneous processes until it stops because it's thermalized. So yeah, entropy has to be maximized, right? As you move to the equilibration, entropy increases, goes through spontaneous processes until it doesn't move anymore. So that thing has to be a maximum kind of entropy, right? So that's the notion of Gibbs thermality, is at a given level of energy, constant energy, you get the maximum entropy possible, right? Agreed with that? Notion of Gibbs thermality, so based on the canonical ensemble. Now, the problem that we have with quantum fields, as you probably know from other courses, is that what are entropies like for quantum fields? What is the maximum and what's the upper bound for the entropy in a quantum field? You know? A constant energy, it's infinite. If you think of a Gibbs state, if you write it, we would look something like this, no? No, that's a thermal state. Everybody agrees with that? Problem is this thing. This thing does not exist in field theory, even for the simplest of theories that you can think of. This thing is divergent. This thing cannot be this is not a density operator. It's not trace class to begin with. All right, so there's a problem. We cannot really define Gibbs thermality. What do we do instead? Well, we have to generalize the notion of thermality to something that is exactly that when that is well defined, but can also be defined outside this. So for the next lecture, we're going to get into KMS thermality, into what's the general definition of thermality. I would argue that something much better than Gibbs thermality, much more general and much better, much more even physical than Gibbs thermality, that hopefully has an element of mind-blowing. As in, like, when you see this property, it's really a cool property. What you call thermality is actually related with correlations in time. So it's like me right now and me in some time, how we correlate to each other is related with thermality. If we're thermal, that's a particular way. Hold on, what observable? All of them. These kinds of properties are hopefully going to be kind of fun to explore. The one thing I have to warn you about is that it will take some amount of complex analysis. Basic theorems in complex analysis, but you have all seen complex analysis. Am I right? All right. So because we're going to talk about holomorphic functions, we're going to talk about some of the theorems that guarantee that things are holomorphic or when they're periodic, something. But hopefully it will be easy to follow. Okay? And when we have that notion of thermality, and only when we have that notion of thermality, I would also prove that it's actually equivalent to Gibbs when Gibbs is well defined. So you don't have to, you don't have to believe that it's the same. You will see it. Hopefully, I want to do all the calculations, all right? That's why I say in an hour will be a little bit tough, but I'll try. At the very least, you will be introduced to it, and hopefully we'll do the whole thing. And only when we have that, we can move and switch to the Andrew effect and understand the Andrew effect and what RQI has to say about the Andrew effect, right? Okay, well, that on Wednesday.